Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Eric Westervelt. You're listening to On Point. Well, just as we got used to the craft beer revolution, brewers big and small are getting a little nervous. Believe it or not, beer sales have dropped some 10% since the mid-90s. Over 20% of 20 to 27-year-olds switched away from beer in the last decade. Just what is nibbling at beer's numbers? Craft cocktails? Wines? It's not exactly a disaster, but it points to an earthquake in the business of booze. Big beer companies are worried. This hour on Point, beer on the rocks in the alcoholic beverage industry. You can join us on air and online. What do you get when you go out? What are you seeing? Is it all IPAs all the time? Have you had enough of hoppy IPAs? Can't get enough? Are you choosing new or different cocktails? Join us anytime on onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. And joining me from London is Sabra Chowdhury. She's a consumer goods and retail reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Her recent story, America's Long Love Affair with Beer, is on the rocks. You can find that and a link to it on our website, onpointradio.org. And Sabra, welcome to On Point.
Thanks, Eric. Thanks for having me.
Appreciate you coming in. So industry numbers show the U.S. market may have reached peak beer sales. What do we know about, you know, what exactly is cutting into beer's big profits?
Sure. So just for context, for a long time, there was a big craft beer boom, and that's something that I think has confused some people when they look at this story. Craft beer growth has slowed recently, but it's still, you know, it's getting to be quite a big slice of the beer industry. The story is largely focused on big beer brands, and those are the ones that still make up about 80% of the beer sector. So brands like Budweiser, Coors Light, Miller Lite, those are the ones that have really suffered. And we're seeing customers, you know, over the last few years moved away from those big beer brands into craft beer, but also much more interestingly, I think, have moved very strongly into spirits in particular. So many more people drinking cocktails, gins, tequilas, bourbon, scotch, and that seems to be one of the biggest things that's really eaten into big beer volumes.
So it's not just craft beer eating into big beer, it's also cocktails. What do you think is driving the return? I know these things can be cyclical, but what's the return to cocktails, do you think? What's driving that?
So there have been a number of things. I think the spirits industry has been quite active over the last few years on lobbying to make sure that their distribution is enhanced. For a long time after Prohibition, spirits was very much in the shadows. Beer was seen as the drink of moderation, the drink that people had at the barbecue with family at a sports stadium. And now I think you see spirits in places that you didn't really see them in before. So walk into any sports stadium now, you will see that you can get cocktails, you can get wines, you can get ready to drink spirits that you couldn't get before. So I think spirits companies have been kind of quite focused on trying to enhance their distribution. And then there was an advertising ban that was self-imposed by the spirits industry that they actually lifted in the early 2000s. And so spirits have gone much more mainstream in terms of ads actually appearing on TV, on radio. That's another thing that I think have definitely really helped. And then this idea of calorie counts, people are becoming more health conscious. We hear alcohol executives across the board saying people are drinking less but better. They're more willing to spend money on a drink, but they want to cut back on the amount that they're drinking. That trend has played in quite nicely into the cocktail culture, where you might spend, you know, $12 on one cocktail instead of spending it on three beers, which has also hurt beer sales. So overall, beer sales as a category are down, and craft beer hasn't been able to make up for that, because when you have a craft beer, it's quite strongly alcoholic, strongly flavorful. So you might have two craft beers in place of five Budweisers.
Right, you're going to drink less of it,
Exactly. From a volume point of view, you're just not going to make up for the declines of the big beers, with even with the craft beer boom.
Well, big beer is pushing back. Anheuser-Busch InBev is the world's biggest beer maker. For the past year, they've been working to boost sales of Bud Light with their Dilly Dilly ads. The slogan, just meant to be silly, has in fact gone viral.
Sir Jeremy, you are a true friend of the crown. Dilly Dilly.
Dilly Dilly.
Madam Susan, you are an even truer friend of the crown. Dilly Dilly.
Dilly Dilly.
Please follow Sir Brad. He's going to give you a private tour of the Pit of Misery.
Pit of Misery. Dilly Dilly.
Dilly Dilly.
And Sabra Chowdhury, I mean, I was actually in a bar not too long ago when a group of people started, you know, chanting Dilly Dilly, and I turned around and said, my goodness, do you realize you're chanting a marketing slogan for one of the world's biggest beer makers? But it shows maybe the impact of these kind of campaigns.
I think the campaign was a hit. Whether that is actually going to lift Bud Light sales on a sustained basis, I mean, I think we'll have to wait and see. I am skeptical, and it's not just because spirits, they're advertising more and their distribution is bigger. I think there are demographic changes that we're seeing in the U.S., so there are more female drinkers, you know, there are more African-Americans, more Hispanics, and so that kind of core beer drinker who is the young white male, who is always the core beer drinker for a number of decades, you know, still exists, but as a percentage of the population has declined. And so I'm not sure that a marketing campaign is necessarily going to address all of those issues. It's certainly a start, but it's quite actually a complicated issue, and there are many reasons why beer sales are down.
How else is big beer responding besides campaigns like that one that went viral? I mean, are they raising prices? Are they taking other measures?
Yeah. So beer makers have raised prices, and this was one of the things that I found the most surprising when I was reporting for this story. We indexed beer, wine, and spirits prices all to the same level and then looked at how they had accelerated over the last two decades. And beer has actually taken way more price than either wine or spirits. And so a bottle of beer is much less affordable now than it was a couple of decades ago relative to what you have on offer from the wine and spirits companies. So beer makers did actually raise prices to try to make up for the volume declines, which I think has actually exacerbated their drops. So that didn't work maybe quite as well as they were hoping. They are doing other things, notably looking outside the U.S. So Anheuser-Busch, which, as you said, is the world's biggest brewer and is very focused on the U.S. It owns Budweiser and Bud Light. They made a huge acquisition in 2016 where they bought SAB Miller, which is the world's second biggest brewer, which was based in London. And with that deal, they got major access to Africa, to Latin America. So these new markets that could be very high growth for them. So I think one big thing beer makers are doing is diversifying outside the U.S. And then they're coming up with new products, with more kind of cocktail-like beers, lighter beers, flavored beers. They're trying to encourage people to drink beer with their meals. So you don't just think of ordering a red wine with a steak. You might think of ordering a stout or, you know, an IPA. And then I think they're also tweaking their advertising for sure to not just with things like Dilly Dilly, but I think just trying to make beer into something that women might want to drink and, you know, Hispanic consumers will consider and African Americans will consider. So I think also taking a much more nuanced look at their ad campaigns and not trying to use the same ad for everybody is another kind of tactic I think that we'll see increasingly.
Sabra Chowdhury is following the industry from London. She's consumer goods and retail reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Sabra, thanks so much for coming on. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And with me in the studios, bringing in another voice, is author and journalist Tom Acatelli. He's written about pretty much the whole alcoholic beverage industry with book titles like The Audacity of Hops, Whiskey Business, and American Wine. He's now writing a book about the history of Pilsner beer. Tom, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
So are things that bad? I mean, is this sort of the end of beer or just a blip?
Well, I think there's two sides. One, from a consumer viewpoint, in the United States, it's never been a better time to be a beer consumer and a drinker. Hmm. The variety out there is absolutely incredible and unimaginable even from 10 or 15 years ago when it was pretty variegated too. On the other hand, to be in the industry at any level, whether you're the biggest brewer in the world, like Anheuser-Busch InBev, or the local brew pub or craft brewery that just started up last week, it's quite a difficult climate.
Mm. And there's a lot of competition.
There's a lot of competition. There's something like 7,000 breweries, or the United States is closing in on that number. It's the most simultaneously ever in the country. So there's so much variety for consumers, but for the industry, it's hard capturing that market share and keeping that market share, because people tend to, and there has been market research on this, they don't necessarily stick with that smaller brand. They come in the next week and they want to try something else in the same style. They don't necessarily stick with the smaller breweries. Mm.
Well, I mean, Steve Williamson writes on our Facebook page, there are just too many choices right now, too many craft beers, too many brewery restaurants. You can't see or drink them all, he says. We're saturated. Is there a risk that it's getting oversaturated?
People like me who've covered and analyzed the industry, we used to say, you know, jokingly 5 or 10 years ago, it's really a question of how much beer Americans can drink. But I think we're actually running up on the answer, and we'll find out soon enough. But I would say this, that the overall beer industry, especially the bigger brewers, have faced this kind of existential challenge before. Mm-hmm. The last time was probably in the early 1980s. California wine during the 1970s had grown dramatically. There were only a few acres of Chardonnay planted in the whole country, and suddenly it was booming. Absolut vodka was introduced in the U.S. in 1979. You had a resurgence of single malt whiskeys for the higher-end consumer. You know, that led to the sort of iconic taglines that we all know, the Super Bowl commercials, and craft beer, which was a very, very, very small segment of the market back then in the early 80s, rode that general wave of beer recovery. So while I think that this is a sort of biggest challenge and most difficult climate of the last few decades, I do think beer has come back. Mm. And that Wall Street Journal article was fantastic, and it caused a lot of buzz, if you will, in the beer world. But as it points out, you know, beer still accounts for 50% of the alcohol market in the U.S., or around that.
Lots more to talk about. We're looking at the beer industry in America today. They're facing some stiff new competition from wines, from spirits. You can join the conversation. Are you still twirling that handlebar mustache and clutching a cold craft beer? Or, you know, are you turning to craft cocktails or wine? And why? Is it health? What's going on there? More to come. I'm Eric Westervelt. This is On Point.
There stands the glass. Fill it up to the brim. Till my troubles grow dim. It's my first one to take.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS ConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
Hey, Asma.
Hey, Scott.
Another crazy week. We've got North Korea.
Yep, we got Russia.
Midterms.
And, of course, President Trump. And what happens whenever there is crazy news that erupts? We pop into the studio and break it down to make sense.
So if you see a headline,
we've discussed it.
It's the NPR Politics Podcast.
It's On Point. You've made it to Friday. I'm Eric Westervelt. We're talking about the changes afoot in America's taste when it comes to alcohol. You can join the conversation. Why do you think certain kinds of drinks come in and out of fashion? What are you drinking? Of course, you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We have with us Tom Acatelli, author of The Audacity of Hops, The History of America's Craft Beer Revolution, and Whiskey Business, How Small Batch Distilleries Are Transforming American Spirits. And Tom, I wanted to ask you, we got a comment on our Facebook page from Jeff Cohut who says, you know, some of the microbrews are getting so out of control, it can be difficult to find the one that's basic enough to enjoy. And I live in California, and I go into some of these craft brew pubs, and they're saying, you know, here's the pineapple cinnamon, lemon sure. IPA. And I just said, I just want an IPA.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, the Great American Beer Festival is coming up, and the Brewers Association, the trade group that represents smaller independent breweries across the country, just released the categories with the most nominations. In other words, breweries nominating themselves. And the top three categories are all brand new, and they all have to do with what's often called New England IPA. The official titles are Juicy Hazy IPA, Juicy Hazy Pale Ale, Juicy Hazy Double IPA. Hmm. Right, so these are very hoppy, very bitter, and generally very strong beers. They've replaced the American style IPA as the number one category at the Great American Beer Festival. So you are seeing that migration toward stronger, you know, more just sort of wild flavors and flavors you would not have seen 10 or 15 years ago. And that's, you know, a great thing for some consumers. Some people love it and they try a new thing every week or every month. But yeah, for the overall market, it can be difficult. But what I think is happening and what you're seeing is simpler beers. You're seeing Pilsners come back. Hmm. You're seeing pale lagers come back. And for a long time, they were ignored critically because the larger macro brewers did them and did not do them that well. And now they're kind of voguish again and coming back.
Hmm. So, the hop race has created a backlash.
Yes, the hops arms race is just about over.
We're going back to simpler things. Let's take some calls. Ben is calling from Cambridge. Ben, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Eric. So thank you for taking my call. I think the thing I think is I love beers, you know, taste like Papa John's pizza. But the thing it gets for me is I think that there's a big health craze. And the calories, the carbs in a beer, people are just looking for hard alcohol as a kind of lower calorie and maybe wrongly healthier option.
Thanks for your call, Tom. I mean, people are worried about health too.
I mean, that enters into it a lot, quite a bit, I think. And that is true. And I think that explains the popularity of some of the clear craft spirits that are coming out, such as gin, such as vodka. But I would also, you know, caution. I said earlier, you know, the end of beer has dealt with this challenge before, and it will most certainly bounce back if history is any guide. Hmm. But, you know, the millennials are embracing the craft spirits. The millennials are embracing rosé wine, the lighter wines. They're migrating away from the heavier beers. And there is a generational lesson in that because in the 50s and 1960s and early 70s, the baby boomers migrated away from bourbon. Mm. Which was a preferred spirit of their parents. Mm. It was the explosive spirit in the United States. And by the late 1970s, it was tanking. And people were talking about bourbon almost in the past tense. Mm. It's, of course, enjoyed a fantastic resurgence behind craft spirits and small batch spirits. But there is a lesson in that with the millennials, the largest generation in American history, migrating toward, not necessarily away from beer, but towards spirits and lighter wines. There could be a lesson there.
And towards craft cocktails. Here is a clip from the cable channel IFC's Portlandia, spoofing the new popularity of the craft cocktail.
That is a ginger-based bourbon drink infused with honey, lemon, and charred ice.
Wow.
Then building off of that base, we've got cherry tomato, lime zest, egg whites, eggshell, egg yellows. Rotten banana.
It adds to like the flavor of it.
Secret of the pros, yeah.
Secret of the pros. I mean, I've had cocktails offered me. They said we've poured some fresh bee pollen in this or something. I mean, it's getting pretty interesting. Yeah. And one could say out of control.
Right. I think there is a tendency to try to one-up the last cocktail iteration, but it's also lifting some cocktails that were sort of not entirely lost to history, but getting there. It's sort of making them more popular again.
Interesting. Let's go back to the phone. Zach is calling from Baltimore. Zach, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Eric. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you. You're on the air. What's your comment?
Yeah, so I've been doing beer marketing for a couple of years now in the Baltimore area and was in retail before that. And, you know, one of the things, I agree with Tom on a lot of it, but I think that some of the challenge that craft beer could be facing is because of, you know, the new hoppy categories like the juicy and the hazy beers, I have a feeling that craft beer might be siloing itself a little bit and kind of doubling down on the hop heads and the beer nerds that are really, like, gung-ho about the hops and the hazy stuff. And maybe at the expense of, you know, women and other beer drinkers who just want to see that variety, that often gets forgotten, you know?
It's a good point.
No, there are dozens of beer styles out there. Absolutely. For a long time, since at least the early 1990s, IPA was ascendant. IPA is an India Pale Ale. It's a style denoted by bitterness, hoppy from the hops. It's generally stronger, generally fuller tasting. And that came to define, for good and bad, craft beer in the United States for consumers here and overseas. And I think, yeah, definitely it's bending away from that. Part of it is the expense. Part of it is the calories. And part of it simply is the resurgence and the renewed interest in some of these lighter but yet fuller, just as full-tasting styles like Pilsner, like Pale Lager, like Bohemian Pilsner, whatever. You're seeing a tilt away from the heavier IPAs. And that's not necessarily a bad thing.
And you're writing a book about Pilsners. I have in my can an unopened can of Jack's Abbey post-shift Pilsner. Is there a return to interesting American Pilsners, and are they trying new things?
Yes, definitely. Pilsner itself was born in what's now the Czech Republic in 1842. It was literally developed by one particular brewer at one particular brewery. And it was the first light-colored beer basically that anybody had seen commercially. There had been lighter colored, but this was sort of golden. This was almost crystal clear. Beer for thousands of years had been dark and cloudy and somewhat unappetizing. And Pilsner kind of changed that. And what happened, you know, in the late 1800s was a wave of German immigration beginning in the 1840s, 1850s, 1860s brought Pilsner and sort of pale lagers to the United States. And that is the style that the style of beer that the U.S. grew up on, kind of. And those styles developed, that Pilsner iteration developed into what we know as, you know, macro or big beer right now. You know, the Budweisers, the Miller Lights.
I'd like to bring another voice right now into the conversation while Tom keeps an eye on the big industry. We want to hear, you know, how it looks from the other side of the bar, people on the front line, so to speak. Abigail Galeau is an award-winning bartender at Compère Lapin in New Orleans. She's also contributed to the book Drinking Like Ladies, 75 Modern Cocktails from the World's Leading Female Bartenders. And she joins us from Albany, New York today. Abigail, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Eric. Thank you so much for having me.
So great to have you and your expertise in New Orleans at your bar, restaurant. What are you seeing? Are you seeing, you know, at least anecdotally, a big drive towards these craft cocktails?
Absolutely. The majority of what we serve behind the bar is craft cocktails. New Orleans is a unique example because it's a cocktail city. It always has been. But I've been there for 6 years. Before that, I was in New York. And for the last 15 years, Tales of the Cocktail has been a worldwide phenomenon descending on New Orleans, with about 20,000 bartenders and spirits industry professionals descending on New Orleans over a hot week in July. And we share so much knowledge and have so much fun. And through my experience there and my experience with seeing the craft cocktail scene grow in both New York and New Orleans over the last 10 years, I can say very proudly that we are the center of the cocktail universe. And so that's why people come to us for cocktails. Wine does very well. We have beautiful craft beers, and we have a craft beer scene happening in New Orleans now. Mm. But it is a little late to the game. It's always been cocktails.
And so, you know, you're seeing more people, you know, moving slowly away maybe from craft beer. They're on a Friday, Saturday night. They're going to order the cocktail, maybe the wine.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And especially we make cocktails with beer and with wine, and people who maybe need that kind of gateway to that, we have that available to them as well.
What's the plus at all for the bar? Is it, you know, are these harder to produce? Are they more profitable? Is it just a wash? Are you catering to the taste? What impact is it having?
The initial investment can be a bit much because there's a lot of training, there's a lot of education, and for a bartender who is working off of tips, it does require more time, more prep. You're kind of almost more like a chef that way, in that you are prepping and creating a menu that is carefully considered and seasonal and changes and has a lot of variety. Hmm. But for the owners in the long run, it is far more profitable, though the cost of cocktails versus the markups on beer and wine is much more profitable to the owners.
What's roughly the sort of the percentage breakdown in orders, you know, you might see every night at your bar if you had to guess?
I'd say about 7% of our sales is beer, about 20 to 30% is wine, and the rest is cocktails.
7% is pretty low. Interesting.
It wow. is. It is. It's not. There are other places in New Orleans that are more known for their beers. We're a restaurant cocktail hotel bar. We're known for cocktails.
Well, Jessica writes on our Facebook page, when I started bartending 15 years ago, I'd have never have imagined I would be making Manhattans and Old Fashions regularly again for these 20 and 30-somethings. I've seen that same crowd steering away from craft cocktails and towards these sort of classic offerings. So it's interesting to see the mix and going back to, you know, the what some people considered, you know, your parents' drink, the Manhattan, the Old Fashioned.
Well, absolutely. I think it's exactly what Tom was saying. It's the baby boomers turn their back on their parents. Well, our parents are baby boomers. We're turning our backs on them now. I'm like, no, no more beer. We want to go back to what grandma and gramps were drinking. Some Manhattans, please.
Let's go to the phones. Rebecca is calling from New London, Connecticut. Rebecca, welcome to On Point.
Hey, thanks for having me. My comment is just that I think that younger generations, including millennials, are more pride ourselves on being more conscious consumers, and that translates into how we buy our beer and our alcohol. We're trying to look for local, independently owned breweries, and we're waning away from those big corporations. We're putting our money towards local, independently owned businesses.
Rebecca, thanks for your call. Yeah, Tom. I mean, as Sabra pointed out, I mean, big beer is worried.
Yeah. I think one of the great side effects of not just craft beer, but craft spirits and a lot of the artisanal wines, the fine wines, boutique wineries in California, Oregon, and elsewhere, is that it's encouraging a kind of seeking out. You know, you have to go to a certain area to get this beer. You have to go to this certain area to try this particular spirit. You know, there's some releases cause quite a lot of pandemonium as people try to get a bottle or even a pint or a growler of a finite amount of a beer run. So I think that's one of the great side effects is that people are, especially younger people, they're seeking out specific independent breweries in specific areas and distilleries and wineries. And I think that's kind of a wonderful thing because for a while, wherever you bought some of it, it didn't matter where you were. You were going to find the same product, the same brands. And now, you know, you really do have to, in a lot of cases, go seek it out. That's great.
Well, we're going to taste, and yes, modestly, just a little taste. We are live on the air here. with thanks to Gordon's Fine Wines and Liquors for providing beverages to look at and to taste, and to Kitty Amon for mixing some of our guest Abigail's cocktails for us. Abigail, what do you have first up for us? It's a classic New Orleans.
This is the Sazerac. This is my take on a Sazerac, which has a split base of both cognac and rye. Some argue that this is the first named cocktail in America. It's the official cocktail of New Orleans. It goes back to the early 1800s, so there's a lot of history there. People come to New Orleans just to have this drink. I was one of those tourists who came to New Orleans and came home with bottles of absinthe and rye and Peychaud bitters because I wanted to make Sazeracs for all my friends at home. And so it's a real kind of classic strong drink from the early 1800s. Think of how rough it was back then and being lit by gas lamps and you need something strong and fortifying. But the history of New Orleans can be told in this cocktail, from the sugar in it to the cognac and rye, our American and French influence, the rinse of absinthe, which is definitely our French influence, the Peychaud bitters, which is our Caribbean Creole influence, and even the twist of lemon becomes the our Sicilian influence.
We're going to do a modest taste here to check it out. Your take on the Sazerac. That's delicious.
It's fantastic.
Yeah, you can find a recipe to Abigail's cocktails and her book on our website, onpointradio.org. Your take on this, what does it do? How is it different from your competitor down the road?
Well, people will argue whether the base should be rye whiskey or cognac. I say, why choose? I do a split base of both.
And what is the splash of absinthe? I mean, is this symbolic or does it really change the
This was
the
very traditional of classic cocktails of that time. A cocktail was just a category of drink. And if you wanted it fancy or improved, you would add a splash of maraschino liqueur or curacao or absinthe. They were just little modifiers that would like heighten the drink. So in the beginning, this is the really kind of the Paleolithic era of cocktails this is coming from, very, very early. It wasn't until the 1860s through 1880s and 90s, you've got the first real golden wave of what they even called mixology at the time, where you had drinks like the Manhattan and the Martini being introduced into the canon.
And briefly, are you seeing where you are, you know, any trend towards the what I call the more foo-foo creative, some might say out-of-control cocktails where they're putting all sorts of stuff in it, all sorts of lost ingredients or bee pollen or things like that?
Absolutely. There's always creative bartenders who really want to kind of put their own impact on a drink. A lot of people take the classics as a basis and then kind of go off from there. There's a great deal of that influence that you see from using local ingredients and using local craft ingredients to really heighten their own personal experience.
We're talking about the shifting tastes in American restaurants, bars, and homes when it comes to what the folks are drinking. When we come back, my guest Abigail Galeau will share another of her craft cocktails, and we will sip modestly, I promise you. This is live radio. You can join the conversation. What's your favorite cocktail? What trends are you seeing out there? What's the appeal? I'm Eric Westervelt. You're listening to On Point.
That's why I want to stop by on my way home and say, now let me tell you one more thing. Ain't no harm to have a little taste, but don't lose your cool and start messing up the man's place. Ain't no harm to take a little nip, but don't you fall down. What's your lip? No, no.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Did cutting taxes actually grow the economy?
And what makes DJ Khaled the king of pop music?
The Indicator, a daily podcast where we tackle the big economic questions.
It's On Point. I'm Eric Westervelt. We're looking at the quiet revolution underway at the liquor store, at restaurants, at bars, and in homes. Industry numbers say we may have reached peak beer. We're seeing a rising popularity in craft cocktails and specialty wines. Join the conversation. What are you ordering and drinking these days? In moderation, of course, and not drinking and driving. What do you decide when you go to wine or beer or cocktails? You know, are you looking at calories? Are you looking at flavor? Are you looking at pairings with food? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guests are Abigail Galeau, an award-winning bartender at Compère Lapin in New Orleans, and Tom Acatelli, author of The Audacity of Hops, The History of America's Craft Beer Revolution. In 1934, the comedy mystery movie The Thin Man was a huge hit with audiences. It featured a crime-solving married couple named Nick and Nora. Here's the dapper, hard-drinking, retired detective Nick at a fancy bar showing the bartenders what it takes to mix a cocktail just right.
The important thing is the rhythm. You always have rhythm in your shaking. Now, in Manhattan, you shake to foxtrot time. A Bronx, to two-step time. The dry martini, you always shake to waltz time.
Always shake to waltz time. And Tom, I'm curious, your take. I mean, more than 30 states have legalized medical marijuana. 9 states have legalized recreational use. Is there any evidence at all that those changing habits based on the law are changing consumption habits of alcohol?
It's not entirely clear yet. And it's not entirely clear yet if there'll be a sort of craft cannabis movement or something like that. But definitely, one of the more interesting aspects of it, I think, is that politicians of both parties, you know, elected officials, all the way up to governor, like to be photographed and like to visit these craft distilleries and craft breweries. Meanwhile, even in states where marijuana has been decriminalized, they're reticent to be seen with producers and with pot shops. So that evolution will be interesting to see if elected officials embrace cannabis, legal cannabis, the way they've embraced the rise in craft spirits and craft beer.
Interesting. And Abigail Galeau, talk a little bit about rum. You've brought in a classic rum. Tell us about that and the story behind it.
Rum is a very uniquely American experience. And, you know, if you've ever seen the musical 1776, there's a big connection to the founding of our country and slavery and rum. So it's been a touchy subject, but it's still made and really, really delicious. And there's been a movement towards people focusing on where their spirits come from and how socially sustainable it is as well. As we grow, we're very conscious of that. And because of that, there's been attention being paid to people who make sure they pay their workers correctly. Mm. And there's been a movement to a kind of grass-to-glass movement when it comes to sugarcane. Hmm. And the island of Martinique, which is a French colony and subject to EU rules and regulations, and in fact is under an AOC, so the French government puts the same regulation on the making of this rum as they would champagne or Armagnac or cognac. Hmm. That care goes into it. And these workers are some of the best-paid workers in the Caribbean because they have 35-hour work weeks and education and healthcare and all those things that we associate with that system. So there's this movement with bartenders to say, oh, well, you know, this is a great product. It's delicious. It has all this history. It has everything I'm looking for, including amazing flavors, and it's socially responsible. So that's rum agricole. It's usually spelled with an H, mm-hmm. rum agricole being French for rum from agriculturally based rum.
Sure, rum. And this is from Martinique, and the stuff you've poured for us is from Martinique. I'm going to smell it more than taste it. I better, given that I'm on the air.
It's but very different. Other rum really is made from molasses, which is a byproduct of sugar production. So this is from fresh-pressed sugar cane.
So it's raw very cane, it's not molasses, yeah?
Yeah.
Yes. Mm. Very distinctly different flavor, and something that's very new that, for American palates, they haven't really been introduced to it yet. I consider the palate of that kind of more similar to something like a tequila, very green and fresh.
Now, if you're in the Caribbean or something, you're going to see lots of different kinds of rums. I'm just wondering if you think there's going to be a quiet rum revolution coming, Tom?
Oh, I think...
Abigail.
Oh, yeah, I think it's... Well, I think it's here. There's
it's
been
here.
Yeah,
a big...
It definitely is here already. Yeah, this is a very, very clean, very grassy. It's fantastic.
Let's go to the phones. Corey's calling from Lexington, Kentucky. Welcome, Corey, to On Point.
Hey, Eric. My name's Corey. I'm 24. I manage a bar program here in Lexington, mm-hmm. and I've definitely seen a massive shift in interest towards cocktails and wine in particular, not just among my guests, but among friends and people my age as well.
Mm-hmm.
But a couple things that I've noticed, I think, that are kind of turning people away from beer in particular. The first is alcohol content. I feel like a lot of brewers are chasing alcohol as opposed to flavor, and people are kind of over the high alcohol beers. And the other thing is like the chasing trends. So you saw barrel-aged beers, you saw gozas, now you see New England IPAs. I feel like people are getting a little exhausted on that, mm-hmm. and it kind of makes the brewery feel a little less genuine or authentic when they're kind of just bouncing around, chasing these trends.
Mm. Good points, Corey. Appreciate your call. Tom, craft beers chasing trends?
That's part of the problem, and that's part of the challenge, is there's so many breweries now throughout the United States, more than any point in the country's history, and there's availability of so many beers from overseas and from the rest of North America. I really do that. That's the prime challenge that craft brewers have, is standing out on crowded shelves. Mm. But I would just add really quickly, you know, 30 years ago, American beer was kind of a joke stylistically and critically. Hmm. And now it really is. You know, these brewers have made it the envy of the world. You know, American brewers used to look to Germany or to the Czech Republic or to Belgium. And now those guys look to us. So that is kind of a sort of underdog triumph story. That's the good side of it.
That's the good side of it. Nina's calling from Connecticut. Nina, welcome to On Point.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. Got a question for Tom?
I wanted to open up the conversation also to craft cider. I work for New England Cider Company, which is a small craft cider company in Connecticut. And I think it's very important to talk about how that's going to be taking a chunk out of the market. And also another level of that is craft cidery mixology. So we mix our ciders on tap for our customers in the tasting room. And then also, we do events where we mix cider with spirits. And I think the same trend is going to happen in beer as well. I think that's just a new upcoming thing that you guys should talk about.
Interesting. Your phone's breaking up. We'll let you go. Thanks for your call, though. Tom, are you seeing
any of
that? I
could definitely see that happening. And I'm sure that is happening, especially in New England. You know, cider, hard cider was the sort of original American tipple. John Adams drank a tankard a day. Johnny Appleseed was planting apples for making hard cider, not for eating. That came much later. So, and cideries are springing up across the country, particularly in the Northeast and the Northwest. Whether it will eventually take a big bite out of craft beer or the larger alcohol market remains to be seen. It certainly spiked at the start of this decade, but it's tapered off a bit. But having said that, there are some fantastic ciders out there. And I would say again that the U.S. competes, if not exceeds, other traditional cider-making countries such as Scotland and England.
And Abigail Gallo in Albany, New York, who works in New Orleans, you have another cocktail for us to potentially taste. Tell us about that, and did you come up with this, or is this your twist on it?
This is a little twist on it, but this is a classic French 75 cocktail. This was created during World War I, named after the artillery gun, the French 75, because it had a little extra kick. Now, some people will, again, this is one of those, like with a lot of history involving alcohol, it can be a little muddled. And some people say it should be made with cognac. Some people say it should be made with gin. Most places you go to will make it with gin. I also like it with that aged rum agricole, which has a cognac-like quality to it when it's aged that way. So, and it's also topped with champagne. So this is one of those cocktails that has wine in it, and it also is basically a Tom Collins with champagne on it. And it's absolutely delicious, elegant. And, you know, the children who grew up in New Orleans, this is one of our kind of signature cocktails. And I always say that our 21-year-olds are so much better off because when they come of age, instead of doing keg stands, they're more sophisticated and drinking French 75s and Sazeracs.
I'm going to take a benefit small of growing up sip in New of this. Orleans. Wow, that is... It's really refreshing.
It's refreshing, yep.
And it's it says kind of New Orleans. I mean, that's just a summertime kind of taste to the whole thing. What do you think, Tom?
I think it's fantastic. It's very refreshing. I'm curious, what kind of syrup is in here?
There's just a simple syrup. So we're talking about just sugar and water.
That's great.
Interesting. Let's go to John, who's calling from Providence. John, welcome to On Point.
So I've been a craft drinker, I guess you would call it, since 1988 when I turned 21 and Gritty McDuff's opened in Portland.
Oh.
And since then, I have gone with as many craft brews as I could get my hands on. And the last 5 to 10 years have been just absolutely fantastic. Two things happened. One is that I think breweries finally caught up to my taste buds, which are unfiltered. One of the reasons that I originally homebrewed, I like unfiltered. Mm-hmm. I like whole-bodied beers and fresh, and that's the other thing. I have not bought anything at a liquor store for 4 or 5 years. I trade with people on Facebook. Huh. We have a huge connection network that extends all over the country. So I get cans from California sometimes. I get them from the Midwest. I get them from Florida, Virginia.
Interesting.
I haven't had anything from New Orleans yet, but I'm looking forward to it.
Maybe
I could get you something from New Orleans.
It's a great trend.
John, maybe Abigail and you could on Facebook trade something. I hadn't heard of that, trading with other people from other states. It's interesting.
Sure. That kind of passion for finding that out is a lot of what kind of is building the craft cocktail scene as well. We have a real passion for sharing our knowledge and sharing local different local things and ideas. And that's why we get together for conferences. And I'm sure there are beer conferences, too.
Mm-hmm. And when you guys talk about this trend toward natural wine, what are you talking about? What's unnatural about just French or California wines? What do you mean by natural wine?
It tends to be a process where, again, it's kind of unfiltered, it's fresh. There's a lot of kind of different technique used in natural wine. I'm seeing it pop up. People are opening up independent liquor stores and wine stores and really kind of focusing on something a little out of the ordinary. I just got back from a trip to Sicily where there were some beautiful wineries still making wines in amphoras. So they're using ancient technique, but with modern grapes. And you see a trend in a lot of restaurants moving towards natural wine as well.
So fair trade, sulfite-free, that kind of thing as well?
It's an evolving definition, too. But yes. But the core of it is, largely unadulterated wine. So
interesting, but an evolving definition. Let's define our terms here. Liz is calling from Ohio, Yellow Springs, Ohio. Liz, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I was curious to all of your experience with Acavis. I noticed a trend in the craft cocktail scene with Acavis, and I was actually up in Ann Arbor, Michigan recently and had a really delicious Acavis by the brand name Norden. And I know it's a newer, trendier spirit, but it's an old spirit, and so I was just curious of everyone's experience with that.
Acavis is, again, one of those regional differences. You'll find that up in places like Michigan because of the immigrants that came there from Scandinavia. It's a Scandinavian spirit that tends to be caraway seed-based in taste, but they have lots of different flavors. The first time I had it was at Chef Marcus Samuelson's restaurant named Acavis in New York City. So he brought that culinary twist to it and introduced us to his one of his native spirits. And that's how that kind of took off for me.
Are you making any cocktails in New Orleans with it, or are you making many?
I really like it in a Bloody Mary. That caraway seed flavor with the Bloody mix is absolutely delicious.
I feel like New Orleans is famous for Bloody Marys. When I've ever been there, mm-hmm. and someone said on a morning, would you like a Bloody Mary? And you hesitate for 2 seconds and then say, actually, I will. I'm in New Orleans for Jazz Fest, and it's very good.
We have a saying: How can you drink all day if you don't start in the morning?
Well, there you go.
That's why I probably couldn't live in New Orleans. Well, love the city, but my God,
it's called session drinking. We're very responsible about it, and it's kind of all day looking for things that have various different alcohol levels. And that's why, again, those really juicy IPAs are not really very popular. It's very hot, and we tend to drink a lot during the day, so we're looking for something a lot milder and lower in alcohol.
Abigail, on a serious note, if you have someone come into your bar who says, I'm the designated driver, or I don't drink anymore, or I'm recovering, and, I just want a non-alcoholic, but I'd like to, not just drink water. What do you offer them? What do you come up with?
Well, that's what's great about having a craft bar program. We have so many different kinds of syrups, fruits. I use coconut water. I use fresh berries. I use teas. There's all sorts of non-alcoholic options for people. And when you have a craft bar program, you have the tools ready to make someone a non-alcoholic drink that's still very, very delicious. And that's very, very important to me because, of course, a lot of people aren't drinking and you're being responsible, and that's absolutely encouraged.
Mm. And Tom, what other trends are you seeing out there that maybe we haven't touched on today?
Well, one of the callers mentioned home brewing, and that has exploded in popularity in the last 30 years. It was basically illegal at the federal level until 1978, if you can believe it. Home winemaking was legalized when Prohibition was ended in the early 1930s. So home brewing has just become a huge hobby out there. Home distilling, still illegal, still kind of dangerous, but that is growing in popularity too, but it's very underground.
Huh.
And I would also say, everything we've touched on now, these fantastic cocktails, the drinks we've talked about, the trends, it just goes to show that the general popularity of spirits and beer and cider and wine in the United States is lifting out of obscurity a lot of things that had been lost kind of to time.
And we are still recovering from Prohibition
exactly,
in a lot of ways.
Exactly.
And I'd say the craft beer movement is what really helped pave the way for the craft cocktail movement. Mm-hmm. In cities where the craft beer movement took off, it opened up the possibility for craft cocktails to excel as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's been a fun hour. Appreciate the insights. We got to go out. I want to thank Gordon's Fine Wines and Liquors for providing the beverages today, and to Kitty Amon for mixing our guest Abigail's cocktails for us here at WBUR. Tom Acatelli, author of The Audacity of Hops, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Appreciate your
Cheers.
Insights. And Abigail Galeau, award-winning bartender at Compère Lapin in New Orleans. It was great talking to you.
Thanks, y'all. Come visit me.
We will. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I hope everyone has a great weekend. It's been fun this week. I'm Eric Westervelt. This is On Point.